My word.
A panel game devised by Tony Fine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another exploration of the wilder shores of the thesaurus with our two teams of intrepid explorers, Dilys Powell and Frank Muir, Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. And we start with a round entitled Odd Man Out, or should it be Odd Person Out? Frank, who is the odd person in this little crowd? Free gift, forlorn hope, toxic poison, and audible click.
Well, I'll tell you what, a phrase that, of that lot which is extremely odd is forlorn hope.
Mm. Yes.
It's very odd because it's not an English phrase at all, it's Dutch. And neither of the words means how we think they mean. You know, the forlorn is verloren and means lost. In the sense of lost at sea or lost in battle. And hope is hoop and means a squad of soldiers. And a forlorn hoop were a squad of soldiers that were sent out as kind of battle troops and were written off as being killed. And for some reason or other, it's passed into English as forlorn hope.
Well, with that, that is the odd man, odd person out. 2 marks to Frank. The rather mundane reason given here for it being the odd person out is that all the others are redundancies, like free gift, toxic poison, and audible. I thought your answer was much more interesting. Antonia, odd person out in this group, the crack of doom, comparisons are odious, a tower of strength, and a foregone conclusion.
Well, some of them are quotations, and perhaps all are quotations.
All are quotations, and the odd one out...
Perhaps is not from the Bible, is it?
No, the odd one out is indeed a misquotation in the context of the others. Crack of doom, where do you think that comes from, a play we mustn't mention?
Well, then that's by the author of A Scottish Tragedy.
That's right, yes.
Yes.
So that's
by the Warwickshire author of A Scottish Tragedy. I like to spoke to have a regional touch about it.
Known as Will Shakespeare.
Yes.
None of them are originally Dutch.
No. To the best of my knowledge.
It doesn't work every time.
The Northern Hoop
fables, yes. A foregone conclusion.
Is one of them a misquotation?
One of them is not from Shakespeare, and is from somebody else. But Shakespeare wrote something highly adjacent. You've got to choose between a tower of strength. Comparisons are odious.
I go for that. I go for comparisons are odious.
Well, what do you think Shakespeare did actually write?
Well, what he actually wrote was to be or not to be.
I think we'll give you your 2 marks.
Isn't the Dutch word odorous?
Yes, the Dutch word, as used by Shakespeare, was comparisons are odorous, but John Donne actually wrote comparisons are odious. Dilys, your group is soliloquy, dialogue, euphoria, and pandemonium.
Some of them are Greek and some are not Greek.
No, I think it's the actual content.
Three of them are Greek.
I think their origin is of less interest than their actual content as words that
you've
written down.
Well, I can give you a perfect reason for omitting one of them.
Which is
the first one.
Mm. Why?
Which is Latin, and the other three are Greek.
Well, we'll give you 2 marks for that, because...
Right.
Again, we have a rather mundane reason down here for picking soliloquy, because all the others contain the five vowels, but soliloquy doesn't.
Well.
But your answer is much better, so you've got your mark.
I think my answer is more learned.
Yeah. Dennis, odd person out in tower, post, fountain and smock. And we're back to Dutch again.
Are we?
Dutch nude theatres.
Smock looks out. The other, you can go to the tower, go to the post, go to the fountain. You can issue an order. Well, you can't really say go to the smock, can you? Well, I mean, you can say it, but it becomes meaningless.
Not quite sharp enough, I think, for this programme.
Is there some strange game in which these are terms and one of them isn't a part of that game?
Yes, and it is Dutch again.
Let me ask you something. Will I feel any shred of guilt at not knowing this?
I think you will heave a great sigh of relief that you never had to learn it.
I can't find any association which fits those four words.
Well, let me put you out of your agony, but all but fountain are types of windmill.
I'll sleep quite freely.
There's erudition for you. And before we go on to round two, here, Frank and Dennis are the quotations you were given for the last round. And Frank's is a room with a view, book, film, song by Noel Coward. And Dennis's is... And this is My Beloved. He's got a song title as well. Song from Kismet, based on Borodin's String Quartet No. 2. Meanwhile, we have a round of significant surnames, or, as some people put it, eponyms. John McAdam actually built a road near my school for the first time, made out of broken stones. His name is now embalmed in the dictionary in the form of macadamized. What did the following gentlemen do that has similarly ensured that their names are preserved for posterity? Frank, the Reverend James Granger of Shiplake in Oxfordshire.
He was a poet and a collector of engravings, and he was also a biographer, and he did a biographical history of England. And he had this bright idea of having a hell of a lot of blank pages so that the customers could shove in their own engravings. And it was a terrible influence on books in the late 18th century and early 19th, because this rather caught on. Very good idea to stick your own pictures in. Where did you get them from? You got them from other books, from illustrated books. So the second half of the 18th and early 19th is littered with vandalised books to make up Granger. I've got a couple of Grangerized books, actually, which are really quite attractive, but a terrible thing. And the whole thing is very sad, I think.
Two marks to Frank. Antonia, her Friedrich Anton Mesmer of Vienna.
Well, Michael, I want you to look into my eyes. deep into my eyes.
I can't, because I might fall asleep for the rest of the programme.
Well, he invented or practiced for the first time what is now called mesmerism.
That'll win you your two marks.
Thanks.
Well done.
He wasn't followed by sort of George Hipknot.
he did the English version. Main thing he did was he had a theory that every illness was due to animal magnetism. Yeah. Your animal magnetism being in the wrong place.
Saint-Sulpice.
And he used to stroke you. If he stroked you, it realigned your animal magnetism. Well, it seemed to me a marvellous excuse for a doctor.
Yeah.
one that may be revived any day now. Dillis, Dr. Thomas Bowdler of Edinburgh. What did he give us?
Took it away.
Or took it away, as Frank says.
He guarded the sanctity of the family.
Yes.
And produced an edition, a cut edition of Shakespeare, which was suitable to very uninstructed mind, I think.
Two marks to Dillis.
He was the Mr. Whitehouse, wasn't he?
Yes, he really was a proper... He was one of a long line of members of my profession who knew what was good for other people.
His whole family were at it. His wife and his daughters were all at it for years and years.
It means he had to give up.
Despoiling the Shakespeare.
He did decline and fall as well, didn't he? He had to give up on Othello, I heard, because he couldn't. There was no way he could clean up Othello. He suggested you put it back in the bookcase. Dennis, Signor Luigi Galvani of Bologna.
I remember at school there was a thing called the galvanometer, which a magnet was involved in, and it measured something to do with electricity, whether it was amps, ohms.
Fogs came into it occasionally. Dead fogs.
That'll do.
No, I wouldn't mess with dead fogs. I'd bring a note on that.
Two marks to Dennis. Well. Galvanism, galvanometer. He discovered that electricity or a current could be produced by chemical action. In fact, it's alleged that his wife discovered it for him by noting that frogs did convulse when they came into contact with metal, but I think that's probably untrue. Next round, business references. A businessman asked to give a reference for a notoriously work-shy employee wrote, "Any employer who gets Mr. X to work for him will indeed be fortunate." another wrote of a contentious workman, "This man is a well-balanced fellow. He has a chip on both shoulders." Now, in the same vein, can you concoct an equally ambivalent reference for some well-known historical or fictional figure, such as, say, Jeeves, Henry VIII, or Lucretia Borgia? Anybody takes your fancy? Frank?
What about a politician, a Scandinavian politician, visiting the Arctic Circle? They were reporting back, "He's a terribly nice man, as honest as the day is long." to adapt, there's a lovely, lovely thing that Disraeli used to say, but to adapt that to writing about somebody. Say Dr. Arnold had Flashman to write a letter to recommend to a bank or something. He would say, the bearer of this letter is an old pupil of mine, Flashman. I would lose no time in interviewing him.
Very neat, very neat. Antonia.
Well, I can imagine myself wanting to hire a cook who was perhaps for a special occasion, for a party, and somebody would come with the most wonderful reference. I would read it on rather nice writing paper. And, I cannot recommend Louisa too highly, that some of the most wonderful, memorable dinners, really, of the whole century have been carried out by Louisa. Her cuisine is really internationally famous. And then now I'm onto a pretty good thing. And you'd eye ran down to the bottom, and you would see it was signed Lucrezia Borgia.
That'll do. Well done. Well done. Dillis, give us a reference for somebody.
I can't think of any kind of ambivalent reference. I can only think of a gentleman in Italy in, I think, the 15th century who sent a message round to say that he was prevented by indisposition from sending thanks for the delicious dinner, but he did hope that he'd be well enough to write tomorrow to the Borgias.
Dennis?
Well, a couple of fictional characters came to mind. Scrooge, if Bob Cratchit had to give if the situation were reversed, he could describe him as a man of rare gifts. and I thought if Baron Frankenstein had to find work for his monster, he could write on a chit, "He's not much to look at, but I know his heart is in the right place."
Thank you. Next round is definitely definitive. Which word is defined as follows in the concise Oxford English Dictionary? Frank. Here's the quotation from the dictionary. I want the word. In a direction contrary to the apparent course of the sun, counterclockwise.
Widdershins.
straight up, 2 marks. Antonia, marriageable, especially of women.
Nubile.
Nubile, 2 marks, Antonia. Dillis, dried bodies of insects reared on cactus in Mexico.
Well, I've never been in Mexico. I don't know about their caterpillars. Are they...
They're tiny insects, and they're very red, and when they grow on the cactus, and they're all crushed, and they produce something...
They turn into caterpillars.
No, they produce something we use in this country. I mean, they use in many countries, and Frank is whispering in your ear...
Try cochineal on the gentleman.
A voice in my rather deaf ear says cochineal.
And cochineal will win you 2 marks. Well done. Dennis, this is the definition. To laugh like an affected, ill-bred or undisciplined girl.
Titter. Titter.
Giggle.
Is it giggle?
Giggle, 2 marks today.
Would you call that particularly girlish, to giggle? I suppose it is. I don't know. There's some laugh words that are very kind of gender-oriented, aren't they? I mean, guffaw is very male.
Bellow.
Bellow is male.
Well done. We now come to Frank and Dennis's quotation, and we start with Frank's, which is a room with a view.
Yes, it was always my ambition, that, to have a room with a view. And I achieved it. I was quite young at the time. I was only about 6'1". At the time, so I was 8, I reckon. about 8. And I was helped very much on my way by my uncle, by my mother's brother, whose name was Edgar Montmorency. We used to call him E.M., because he had E.M. embroidered on his shirts and all over him. He was so rich. And we went to see the cars racing at Brooklands, and it made such an impression on me. Racing cars had this wonderful, pungent, Middle East, hot, exciting smell. And I was determined to... This is what I was going to do. I was going to reproduce this. It was the two senses of the ears, the noise, and the smell that I want to reproduce. So I got myself a bike by a ferry cycle, actually, which was difficult to ride when you're 6'2". You had to pedal like fury. But I swapped it for my dearest possession, which was a 5-shilling Ingersoll watch. Do you remember those? They're American. And mine was a trick one. I discovered it was marvellous, because if you say, what was the time, you show them the right time, and they say it's a bit slow, and bang it. And the top and the glass used to fall off. and the wheel, the flywheel thing, used to fall out and dangle on the end of the spring. And you could coil it back and press it back, and it went. And I swapped this for the ferry cycle. So I had my ferry cycle. Now, to get the noise, and my uncle, E.M., was terribly kind to me. He said, what you do, you see, is you put a bit of cardboard in the spokes. And I tried that, and by golly, it worked. It went, like this. But it wore out very quickly. So I borrowed from the vicar of the Congregational Church one of his celluloid collars. Well, they used to have those in those days. And the celluloid would go into the spokes, which were whizzing round, you see, being such a small wheel. And you've got this tremendous... Now, the smell. I went to the chemist and got a little bottle of castor oil. And when you live in a seaside place, you prospect all the time in the evenings on the beach, and you pick up things, and people drop things out of their rolled-up towel. And there was a kind of garment, lacy kind of garment, like a very, very brief vest, with shoulder straps and with pockets at the back for the shoulder blades to go. And I had one of those, and I found two stones, two big pebbles, which more or less fitted it, and I heated the pebbles in the oven on this big day that I was going to try out my bike with some on the recreation ground. And I heated the pebbles, and I put them in the cups of this vest, wound round with cotton waste. And they were terribly hot. And really, it was quite awkward cycling to the recreation ground. And then when I was there, I poured my little bottle of castor oil on these hot stones and onto this waste, the castor oil. And the smell, as soon as they hit the hot stone, was exactly like Brooklyn's. And I pedalled furiously round on my little ferry cycle, leaving two twin jets of pungent smell behind me. And my mother was there to see me. She didn't want to occur at all, but Ian Forster. And I had achieved my ambition. It was a very noisy thing. It also had the smell. It was a hum with a sheen.
Evoked a lot of memories of youth there. Dennis, and this is my beloved.
Dear Velma, I enclose herewith two documents in connection with my investigations into the murder of your late husband. The first is my report, the second, my bill for fees and expenses. It was Thursday evening when you came back into my life, Velma. I'm sitting in my office when suddenly... Hello, Ed. Remember me? Like always, the mere sound of your voice started my hormones doing the bossa nova. And when I turned, there you were, leaning against my door, inspecting the sign that said, Ed Strong, Detective Agency. We're number two, so we pry harder. Ed, you said, I need your help. It's tiny. What is, I said. Tiny FitzArthur, you said, my sixth husband. They've just found him drowned. Well, I said, it happens. Yes, he said, but this was in my drawing room. It wasn't the first time, Velma, that a husband of yours had checked out in unusual circumstances. The one after me was hit by a runaway supermarket trolley at the corner of Spices and Sardines, while your third suffered a heart attack due to someone putting his aerobic exercise tape on fast forward. Noticing the expression on my face, you said, this time the insurance company are refusing to pay out. Please, Ed, you said, help me, if only for the sake of little Cyril. You always did know how to get to a man. Little Cyril. Funny name, perhaps, for a goldfish. but that's what you insisted on calling him when I bought him for you so you wouldn't be alone in the house all day. I guess it was for his sake I took the case, and an hour later found myself kneeling on your carpet beside the chalked outline of a body. Unusual place for a person to drown, I mused. Especially, I added, as my informant at the water board tells me all the water in the house was turned off that afternoon. I got back to my office that night with my brain in a turmoil. All I knew about the dead man was that Tiny was an ironical nickname given to him on account of him being exceptionally small-statured. And B, he had recently brought himself to the edge of financial ruin by diversifying when he should have conglomerated. But even if Velma had got rid of him for the insurance, how could she have drowned him in a drawing room of a house where all the water had been turned off? 1,000 unanswered questions tumbled around my brain. I tried smoking a little pot, but the handle kept getting in the way. Was it possible there was something I'd noticed that I hadn't noticed I'd noticed? Yes, there was. It had troubled me when I was kneeling on the carpet. A faint, elusive perfume, a slight but pervasive aroma of what? Then it came to me. It was curry. In that moment, everything fell into place, which is why I phoned you, Velma, with the all-important question. Velma, I said, I don't remember seeing little Cyril this afternoon. When you answered, there was a catch in your voice. I'm sorry, Ed, you said. Little Cyril died last month. But he didn't, did he, Velma? Because I remembered that curry I smelt was the one you'd once cooked for me. So hot that after one mouthful, it felt like my eyeballs were switching sockets. All I wanted to do was get to the nearest cold water tap. Which is exactly how it was with Tiny, wasn't it, Velma? Except that you knew that when he went dashing for a mouthful of cold water, there wouldn't be any. And with all the taps dry, there was only one other source of cold water available to a desperate man. And that's how a man can drown in his own drawing room, Velma. If he's so physically small that when he puts his lips to the edge of a goldfish bowl, his ruthless wife can shove his head right inside. Velma, how you dispose of your husbands is your business. But when it entails the death of an innocent goldfish, that's something that cries out for vengeance, which is why I'm at present waiting for the insurance company to call me back. In the meantime, as I've mentioned, I've got two documents for you. This one is my report, Velma. And this is my bill. Love, Ed.
Another tale from the Raymond Chandler of Golders Green. Thank you very much. I see from the scoreboard down at the gasworks end that our winners are Dillis and Frank. So they can retire to the pavilion while Antonio and Dennis help me roll the covers back over the wicket to ensure it stays in good nick for their next sparkling innings. And until then, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell is in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Shrine and Pete Atkin. You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.